This evening, we're going to have a look at the psalm in a kind of general sense, but also I want to think particularly about the words that we find at the end of verse 12, where David's spirit, or David's prayer rather, is this. He says, "Lord, grant me a willing spirit to sustain me. Grant me a willing spirit to sustain me." I don't know if you're a fan of the jigsaw puzzle, but I am willing to tackle any jigsaw puzzle, no matter how complicated or big, as long as it's not got more than 16 pieces. So beyond 16 pieces, I lose interest and patience. We had a jigsaw somewhere recently, and I think it must have been on holiday somewhere, and it was a horse. It was a 1,000-piece jigsaw of a horse, and it really was the most boring activity that one could ever imagine, putting this horse. Everything was brown or green, horse in a field, and it was pretty much impossible. But of course, jigsaws are just about trying to work out where things fit in. And that's one of our issues in life, personally, quite frequently, is trying to work out how do I fit in? How do I fit in socially? How do I fit in at work? How do I fit in my family? How do I fit in at church? So if you're new to church, you might be sitting here looking around and asking yourself, how do I fit in with the people here? So a lot of time in life, we feel sometimes awkward or uncertain of our own identity, who we are, and of how we then relate to people around us. And I think that in the Old Testament, we read about God's people, the nation of Israel, and very often they struggled with exactly those kind of issues. So Israel, very often you find her as a nation having a bit of an identity crisis. Who are we in this world? So Scotland is trying to work out exactly the same thing just now. What's our identity as a nation? How do we relate to the nations around us in the UK or in the European Union? So Israel was a very different kind of nation. It was a theocratic nation. God was its king. It lived by religious law. And this made them very distinctive from other nations round about. And often they didn't quite know, how do we relate to these nations? So that's one of the things, you know, identity, who are we? And when we're trying to work out how we fit in, the second thing that comes along then is perhaps often a pressure to adapt and to change to fit in with those around us. So socially, often we make ourselves kind of a bit more flexible, I suppose, just to try and get on with the people around us. And that happens to Israel in the Old Testament. She becomes more flexible than God wants her to be in order to kind of fit in with the other nations around her who have a very different view of many issues in life, of who God is, of how life should be lived, of human sexuality, lots of different opinions. And Israel begins to change the way she does things to fit in. And that doesn't just happen to Israel, is it? It happens to us as individuals. So if you're a Christian, you know that very often you want just to fit in with the people around you. And that's going to then, at times, cause you to be more flexible about how you behave and talk than you really want to be or ought to be. And that's, I think, part of what's going on in the life of this man here, David, who was king and ruler of Israel. That over a period of time, he has adapted how he lives and what he does and in a sense, compromised that so that his behavior, his ethics, his values don't reflect God's values so clearly anymore, but come to reflect the values of the other peoples around him. And the more he takes on the values and the identity of the other peoples around him, the more unwilling he becomes to really love, honour, praise and delight in God. And if you're a Christian, you'll understand what that experience is like. Because as Christians, there are times when we find ourselves taking on the values of the world around us, the behaviour of the world around us, and we become more and more unwilling to really pray, to seek God passionately, and to ask, what is God looking for in our lives? So there becomes a reluctance in our relationship with God. And that's where David is. He's reluctant in his relationship with God and unwilling to really engage with God as God. So he's going through the outward rituals of his religion, but inwardly, he's not really seeking God. He's not really pursuing God. He's not really wanting to meet with God, know God, see God, experience God. And there's that unwillingness to engage with God, and then at the same time, a willingness to do things that before would have been unthinkable. So, when Christians struggle with their identity as Christians, when Christians struggle to know, you know, how flexible should I be in my behaviour, how far do I mould in with the values of the people around me, and when we become too influenced by those values and when we become reluctant to really engage with God, we find ourselves willing to do things that at best we would never contemplate. So we begin to enter thoughts, to entertain thoughts, to entertain ideas, to entertain doubts, to entertain desires or relationships that are really ungodly and unholy. And then we become willing to cross boundaries that we thought we would never cross. We begin to be willing to break taboos, to open up parts of our life to things that have no place in the life of a Christian. So what do I mean? Well, David is a good example, isn't he? Here's David in this situation that we read about in 2 Samuel, and he's willing to do things that I think that an earlier stage in his life would have been utterly unthinkable for him. And he's willing to enter into a world that for the believer is completely alien. So here's David. What's he willing to do? Well, he's willing to stand and look at Bathsheba bathing naked. And then he's willing to risk everything he is and everything he has to have an affair with her. And then we read about how he became willing to deceive her husband. And he tries to persuade the husband, come back from the battlefield, go and sleep with your wife, so that the pregnancy, he would think the pregnancy was from their own relationship. And then, of course, he's willing to have David killed, or Uriah killed. Now, if you've read much of the Psalms and other parts of the Old Testament, then you know that David was a man who in his earlier life breathed passion for God. He spoke powerfully and with great depth about spiritual life. His words ring with authenticity when he speaks about who God is and how God works in the lives of people. And David in his own society was a man that was loved, looked up to, trusted and respected. He was a leader, a man that God had used in mighty ways. So here's somebody with profound spiritual insight, somebody that God has really worked in powerfully, somebody that God has used in great ways, and all of a sudden he finds himself in this situation where he's willing not only to think the unthinkable, but to do the unthinkable, to take somebody else's wife, and then to have the man killed to cover up his own sin. And of course that shows us what we're capable of as human beings. That even those of us who are Christians have to deal with the issues of greed, temptation, lust, envy, coveting other people's money, jobs, success, popularity, husbands, wives, and so on. And as David looks at what he's done with Bathsheba and her husband Uriah, what does he say? Well, what he realizes is that it's a kind of mirror into his soul. This isn't a kind of one-off blowout, but rather David understands that what's happened with Bathsheba is a reflection of who he really is. And so he's got this confession before God that sin really is just part of his makeup. I was sinful at birth, he says in verse 5. Sinful from the time of conception onwards. The deeply rooted problem of sin is one that we're born with and that we grapple with all our life. David understands that. And now he has to work out where he goes from there. Because he's got blood in his hands, doesn't he? He's got another man's life on his hands and on his conscience. He's got a massive stain on his soul. The two things that David has done were offered no forgiveness under the law of Moses, which was the law that operated in Israel. So adultery and murder both brought the death penalty in that society. So David understood that technically he deserves the electric chair of Israel. And he understands that there's nothing that he can do to make this right. And his life has become a guilt-ridden mess. And in that mess and in that guilt, what he sees is this, that the only thing he can do is beg God for mercy. And the amazing thing of God hears what David is saying, so God is listening, and God does show him mercy. God brings the forgiveness he prays for. God makes him clean. God gives him a fresh start and a new beginning. So David has understood the destructive power of what he's done and of his sin. And in verse 10, he prays to God, "Create in me a pure heart, O God." Now that word "create" is the same word that's used in the Old Testament for creation, for the making of this world out of nothing. And so David is saying, you need to do something new in my life, God. You need to do something that no one else can do. You need to create something for me that isn't there. What can God create for David that no one else can create? Well, he says, create for me a pure heart. How can this guilty, stain-sinned heart be pure? Well, he prays, God, give me a pure heart. Create in me a pure heart. Renew, create a steadfast spirit within me. So only God can restore what sin has destroyed. And I think if we were in David's shoes, and surely there are times in our lives where we find ourselves in David's shoes, maybe not with exactly the same things we're guilty of, but for some of us, yes, exactly the same things. But with our own guilt, shame, regret, destructiveness. And I think we would pray for the same things as David. Give me a pure heart. Give me a steadfast spirit. Don't throw me away or cast me away from your presence. We would ask, I'm sure, Lord, give me back the joy that I've lost in my life. Give me back the Holy Spirit. But I'm really interested that one of the things that David asks for is this: grant me a willing spirit to sustain me. So if you were asking God to sort out your life and to sort out the mess that you've made of your life and the things that you've done because of sin, you know, you would ask for forgiveness, you would ask for joy, but would you say, Lord, give me a willing spirit to sustain me? So what is David asking for there? Well, a lot of what David has asked for is about dealing with the past. You know, wipe out the past. Give me a new start, a new heart, a new beginning. But in this line, what David's praying for is the future. And he's saying, how can I face the future in the light of what's gone wrong and the things I've done? And he's saying, how am I going to face the future and not just do the same terrible things again? And so he's praying to God and saying, what I need from you is a willing spirit to sustain me. Because David understood that one of the original problems, and this is where we kind of started off, is the reluctance that comes upon us to really live for God and to really give everything in our lives for God in a loving and passionate and thankful way. And we become reluctant servants, reluctant Christians. And when we become reluctant, then that's when so much of the doubt, the sin, the compromise begins to kind of eat its way into our lives. And so David is saying, Lord, I don't want to be reluctant in the future. I want to be a willing, passionate Christian who will give everything for God. So how can I make it in the future? That's what David's asking. How am I going to make it? I'm not going to make it, he says, unless you give me that willingness, that desire, that passion to live the right way. And so I want all of us just to really seek from God a willingness to live for God in the future. Now, I don't mean like the future 2050 or 2030 or 2020. I mean the future like tonight, this evening, tomorrow, through the week ahead, through the months ahead. How am I living my life? Am I living my life in a way that is really passionate and committed to God? Am I willing, joyful in how I serve God? Because one of the really irritating things about church is that so often Christians are kind of reluctant and slightly miserable and downbeat about living the Christian life. And, you know, that's dull, isn't it? That's kind of saps your energy. And what we want are Christians who delight to live for God and who delight to serve God in this world and who delight in giving their lives for God's glory. I'm going to just say two or three things, I'll try and say them pretty quickly, about how David needed to be willing in the future. And one of the things that he needs to be willing about, surely, is that he needs to be willing as he works for God in this world. He has a really responsible job. He's a king, so it doesn't come with a great deal more responsibility than that. And as many people in the workplace do, he carried a lot of responsibility. Israel had many enemies who wanted to kill and destroy the people of Israel. Israel needed a strong, stable economy. It needed the administration of justice. Those things were David's working responsibilities. So that's a huge pressure. And of course, he's really blown that. And in front of his colleagues and those around him, he's kind of self-destructed. And so he needs to get back out there into the work that God's given him to do in a way that will really, he'll willingly, lovingly serve God well. Now, I understand, you know, we have lots of different work contexts, but for lots of Christians, work is a tough place. And so I want to say just two or three things about willingly serving God in the workplace. First of all, I want you to know your work is your ministry from God, or part of your ministry from God. So you serve God in the church, you serve God in the community, you serve God in the workplace. So many Christians separate work from the rest of their Christian life. You know, my Christian life is when I go to church or when I read the Bible. Work is what I have to do to earn a living. Well, no, work is where you go as part of your serving God. So work is part of your Christian life. God values your work and thinks it's very important. And God wants you to use your work as a way of glorifying Him. And so when you go to work, you are there to serve God and glorify Him. And you are there to serve your colleagues, customers, clients, whoever it is. So that means living with integrity and compassion in the workplace. So David, as a king, had a huge working responsibility. And he needed to really be willing to live that out in a way that was glorifying to God. And in the workplace, you have to say, how am I glorifying God in this situation? And how am I blessing the people I interact with in the work situation? Second thing I want to point out is just that what David did here had an absolutely horrendous, as you can imagine, horrendous impact on his family. Devastating. And his family life was never the same again. And yet, it was just part of an attitude in David's life that went way back. An attitude to women, to sex, to marriage, to power, that was really unhealthy. He already had, before he commits adultery with Bathsheba, he already has multiple wives, lots of different children, and a tremendous amount of bitterness has come out of that into his family life. So he's got a good number of children from a good number of different women. And now he's betrayed all of them. And the consequences are horrendous. And so he needs to be willing to go back into his family and to serve them in love. And that's a hard thing to do. Trying to build a grace-filled, Christ-centered home is not easy. Trying to nourish and cultivate the spiritual lives of our families is tough. We need to be willing to really persevere at that. Some of us don't have family, biological family around us, or people we're married to. We live on our own. But of course, family biologically is one representation of the family of God. You know, it speaks to us of the greater family, which is God's family. And so it's very important to think, how does my life not only impact on the people I share my home with, I'm married to, or my children, how did my life impact on the believing family? How do the decisions I make impact on the believing family? And how do the bad decisions I make impact on the believing family? Because let me tell you this, your sin is my problem, because I am your brother in Jesus, and we are one in Christ. And that makes my sin your problem. So there's a book, You Can Change, Tim Chester wrote it. He says this, personal sin is a corporate problem. And then he goes on to say, personal holiness is a corporate responsibility. So in the family of God, what are we supposed to be doing? We're supposed to be helping each other to grow more like Jesus and live holy lives. And so if some of us within the family of God decide to make an idol out of pornography or sex or money or alcohol or drugs or anything else, then that has a really bad, destructive impact into the family of God. And it wounds us all. And so what I need from you is you to help me to be a holy person, to be a godly man, to pray for me, support me, listen to me, advise me. And you also need to be willing to have other Christians in your life, in your family, who will encourage you and support you and rebuke you. How did David get all this sorted out? It's when Nathan the prophet came to him and told him a story that helped him to see the gravity and the evil of what he'd done. And one man came to another one and said, listen, look at what you've done. And so you need people in your life with whom you have that kind of relationship. And that goes against the grain for us, of course, because we live in a very individualistic culture and society. And we don't want people telling us or speaking to us about deeply personal things. We want to make our own choices and deal with them in our own way. That's not how God expects it to work in the family of God. So you need to be willing at that level to engage with God's family. And lastly, just really briefly, he keeps saying, be willing to be used by God. Because one of the things that's very interesting about David is he was a prophet. And he spoke for God. So he'd all his life, you know, throughout his life he'd been speaking prophetically, sometimes incredibly. You look at some of the Psalms and how David spoke about God and the prophetic way in which he spoke about Jesus Christ and the sufferings of Jesus. And it's absolutely astonishing how God spoke through this man in his own generation, and God still speaks through what this man wrote today. And so he's got this calling in his life to speak for God, and he's been used powerfully by God in the past to do that. But can he be used in the future? Or is he now useless to God? And what he says is, he goes on to say, listen, if you will give me that willing spirit to sustain me, then he says in verse 13, I will teach transgressors your way. I will turn sinners back to you. Verse 15, open my lips and my mouth will declare your praises. So he's committed to going back into this vocalization, the speaking out for God. Telling what God's done. Being used by God. Now, that's not a calling that's unique to David. All of God's people need to be willing to speak in God's name. All of God's people need to be willing to tell others what God has done for them. And yet very few of us are willing at that level to really speak clearly and say what God has done for us. So how can we be a willing people for God? People who really are committed, passionate, energetic for God in this world. I think we would all like to be like that if we're Christians. But where does the willingness come from? Where does the energy come from? Where does the passion come from? How can it be sustained over time? It's easy to walk out of church and try and live a good life for a few hours or for a few days. But then, of course, we fall flat on our faces again. So how can you be sustained over the long term in living a life that is really pleasing to God? How can you have that willingness in your life, not just for a few hours, but over years? And the willingness comes from seeing what God is like. Because when you see what God is like, then you see that God is worth loving with everything you've got. At the start of this psalm, David says, have mercy on me, O God, according to your unfailing love, according to your great compassion. See what he's doing there? He is nailing God's character. He's saying, what are you like? Why? How is it I can ask you for forgiveness? He says, I ask you for mercy according to your unfailing love. That's your character, unfailing love. What are you like? Well, according to your great compassion, blot out my transgression. So what David does in this prayer is he appeals to what he knows of God. According to your loving kindness and the multitude of your mercies, have mercy on me, O God. And let that love be directed towards me personally. So he knows a truth about God, that God is a merciful and loving God. And then he asks that that truth be directed to him personally. Let your love come to me. And so as Christians, we go to the cross, and there we see very clearly set out God is love. Because there God in his Son, Jesus Christ, is willing to suffer at great cost for us. And that speaks to us of the greatness of God's love, that he will suffer in this way for people. And we want to say to God, let that love be directed to me. And as we see God's love directed towards us personally, then we have awakened within us more and more love for God. And the more your love for God is awakened, the more you will be willing to live, to die, to do everything for Jesus Christ. The willingness comes from the experience of grace and love and mercy. And so, what I need and what you need is to experience every day the grace, love, and mercy of God. So you need to go to Jesus now, as I need to go to Jesus now, and just pray again, as we need to pray daily, have mercy on me, O Lord. And we need to pray that God will free us from the guilt of our own sin and cause us to love him richly and fully. One of the interesting things we see with David here is this, is that he's not wanting to escape really so much the consequences of sin, but what he wants is to escape from the sin itself. So you see, you get people who become religious or they become Christians because they're afraid of the consequences of sin. You know, I don't want to go to hell. I don't want to be judged. I don't want the bad karma that's going to come from the bad stuff that I've done. And so their motivation in becoming a Christian is purely negative. They want to escape the consequences of sin. But in Christianity, the motivation for becoming a Christian is positive. It's loving Jesus for what Jesus has done for us. And when we love Jesus for what Jesus has done for us, we don't just want to escape sin because of its consequences. We want to escape sin because we see how much sin cost Christ on the cross. So one way of putting that then is to say, it's not the consequences of sin for me that move me. Rather, it's the consequences of my sin for Christ that move me. To see him pierced, crucified for my sin is what breaks my heart and makes me want to turn from my sin to know and love Jesus Christ.